This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Therese Bartholomew was very close to her brother Steve. She called him her other half. So it was enormously traumatic when Steve was murdered in 2003. She was angry at her killer, of course, but she also wanted to know more about him. She would eventually meet him in prison in what became a true healing process. That process is also called restorative justice. Defining restorative justice isn't easy. Broadly speaking, it views crime as a harm in need of repair. And to repair that harm, it takes a cooperative effort that includes all the stakeholders, the victims, the offenders, and the community. This week, Campbell University School of Law in Raleigh will host the third annual National Conference on Restorative Justice. Experts and activists will gather at the Sheraton Hotel for a three-day event. Therese Bartholomew will speak at the conference. She joins me here today. Therese documented her story of restorative justice in a film called The Final Gift, and she's written a memoir called Coffee Shop God about her brother's death. Therese Bartholomew, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about the day that it happened. Steve was 33 at the time of his death, involved in an altercation with a man who was then 22 years old, Carl Staten. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, my brother was actually out of town on business. He lived in Charlotte at the time and was a salesman, was out of town on business in Greenville, South Carolina, decided that he would go to a club that was, half a mile away, went there for happy hour. It was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon when he arrived there, got into some sort of altercation, were fairly unclear on what exactly happened there because we've heard a lot of different stories, but got into an altercation with this young man, Carl. They were both asked to leave the club, and when they did, the altercation continued in the parking lot. They started to fight. My brother actually swung at Carl, and when he did, Carl pulled a gun and shot him close range in the heart.
You saw Carl shortly thereafter, 3 weeks later, at a bond hearing. Tell us what happened then.
I did. I drove from Charlotte to Greenville for that bond hearing. And, my husband had asked, well, do you want me to go with you? And I said, no, I feel like this is something I need to face alone, and I'm not sure why, but I feel like it is. So I went into the courtroom and saw Carl for the first time. And the first time I saw him, I seriously contemplated what would happen. What could I do to him without getting in trouble? Mm-hmm. And I think that was a really human response, to feel like in some way I needed to defend or avenge my brother.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, what were your thoughts? And I'm imagining, too, that ride to Greenville. What were you thinking on the way down about even why you were going and what might happen?
Well, I just contemplated just the state of our life, more than anything. It was very much of a dreamlike drive. Every part of the initial part of my brother's murder was just, it was like being in a dream state, just a sense of constant shock. I had no idea how I would respond to this person. My brother was absolutely the closest person in my life. And had been for years and years. And I really took for granted the idea that he'd always be there. So to have to face something like this is just something that's hard to describe. But getting there, the reality really hit me that, I wanted to in some way avenge my brother as I sat there. And that feeling quickly left me.
In the courtroom?
In the courtroom.
What happened?
And believe me, it was very shocking when it did leave. I just had a feeling come over me. I was looking at Carl and kind of studying him and thinking about the fact that he was just a human being. At the end of the day, that's what he was. So I really feel in my mind like that was a moment of grace. As I look back on that, I don't know how I would have survived without that moment of grace. Mm.
In that moment, though, was it difficult for you? You go in there wanting to avenge. That suggests some connection, some kind of loyalty to your brother. Can you? What about those feelings? Where were they when this epiphany happened?
Well, they kept pushing their way back up because that created a real conflict in me. I just think in terms of as a society, you know, we're really kind of raised to some degree, even though I was raised by wonderful, compassionate, loving parents, we're raised to some degree to say you can fight back. You know, if somebody hits you on the playground, you can hit that person back. You're well within your rights, so to speak, to do that. And so that was a real conflict for me. In some sense, I felt like, you know, I questioned myself, am I being disloyal? One of the things that I called and asked my husband on the way home, I literally pulled over on the side of the road, you know, crying because I was so conflicted about this feeling that I had. I called him and I said, do you think that I don't love my brother if I forgive the person who killed him? And he paused for a second. Of course, he had no clue what had just happened. And he said, no, actually, I think that that means you did love your brother and you do love your brother, that you're willing to forgive for him.
And you did. Did you do it fully in that moment? And is that when you decided to make a film?
Well, actually, I decided, and no, I don't think I did it fully in that moment. And certainly I didn't voice that to Carl in any way. It was something internal for me. And as far as making the film, what happened is about a year later, after just a year of horrible grief and depression and not knowing who I was anymore, trying to figure out life, trying to figure out who to be next without this person there beside me who had so much defined who I was and who I became, I sat up in bed in the middle of the night one night, just sat straight up and woke my husband and said, I'm going to make a film. And he said, okay, that sounds wonderful. And at that point, I think he was thrilled because I had quit my job. I was teaching high school at the time. I think he was just thinking in terms of, okay, she's going to have a reason to get out of bed every day. He didn't. He just said, I think that's wonderful. And he never said, you know, did you know you don't have a camera? Did you know you don't know anything about film? These are a couple of things you might want to think about.
Had you actually met Carl? He was convicted of voluntary manslaughter.
Correct.
Well, how did you feel about that? Did you feel that that was a correct sentence?
Well, I mean, I guess looking back in the moment that we that he was sentenced, I didn't necessarily feel it was fair. But more of the reason that I felt it wasn't fair was because there had been other people sentenced that same day for things that didn't involve killing another human being. So,
well, and I gave the charge, which is voluntary manslaughter. What was the sentence?
The sentence is it was actually 10 years. Mm-hmm. So he was charged with voluntary manslaughter. He got a 10-year sentence and had to serve 85% or has to serve 85% of that. And so, you know, that was hard.
Because there were people being convicted of drug convictions, 15 years and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Trying to figure out how that.
Exactly. So trying to, in my mind, kind of write that, like, yeah. Seems like my brother is worth more than this drug charge. But it's one of the things, I mean, I just learned to accept it. I'm not angry about it.
When did you meet Carl?
I met Carl in December of 2010.
So it would have been about 7 years later, 7-8 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And he was still serving his sentence.
He was, yes.
And what happened? Describe that meeting.
Well, it was, to say the least, probably the most important thing I've ever done in my life. I would say the most empowering thing I've ever done. For once, I felt like I had some control over something that was going to happen. And that was really, really important to feel that after years of feeling a sense of no control. He was receptive, obviously, to meeting me because that's part of a victim-offender dialogue. And the process is having him agree to that meeting. He agreed to be part of the filming. And, you know, the meeting was exactly what I expected it to be. It really was more about connecting on a human level, sitting across the table from him, and just seeing him as a person.
Had you been in touch by mail?
I had tried to contact him one time, probably about a year and a half before that, sent him a couple of letters to ask if he would be willing to meet with me. That was before I realized that South Carolina had been trained and was ready to do these victim offender dialogues. So I didn't really know who to reach out to. So I was reaching out on my own, which was probably, I mean, now, as much as I know, is a horrible idea.
It's best to have mediators involved, and they did have a process. What did you say to him?
Well, I offered him forgiveness, whatever that meant to him. I felt like I needed to say it, so it was more something I wanted to say rather than something I felt like he needed. You know, we talked for 4.5 hours, and we really talked about just life. You know, where did he grow up? How did he grow up? Who is his family? What does he plan on doing when he gets out of prison? And, you know, what the impact of this whole thing, just being in prison, what will that take? What will he take from that, you know?
What did he say to you about killing your brother, about taking your brother's life?
Well, a lot of that will come out on the film. But, you know, what he said was he never apologized to me. If I had gone in there expecting an apology, I would have been very, very let down. I didn't have that expectation because going in there was honestly more about something inside of me than trying to get something from him. So he gave me some explanation of things that had happened. My expectation when I went in was that he would make excuses, and he didn't. That was really shocking to me. I almost fed him things that he could use as excuses, and he never tried to justify what he did. He took responsibility for it and didn't try to explain it away. You know, my childhood was terrible or whatever. And I really kind of expected that he would.
Well, this, as you said, has been a healing process for you. We'll talk more about why you feel that way and how this process can work as we expand our conversation today. I'm talking with Therese Bartholomew, filmmaker and director of The Final Gift, talking about her quest to find humanity in her brother's killer and healing and meaning in his death. Coming up, we'll dive deeper into restorative justice, talk with the grandfather of the movement, Howard Zehr, on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today on the program, talking about restorative justice ahead of the third National Conference on Restorative Justice being held in Raleigh this week. I've been talking with Therese Bartholomew about her film, The Final Gift. It documents her successful efforts to arrange a meeting in prison with the killer of her brother. She's with me in the studio today. Now I'd like to welcome Amy Elliott. She has spent more than a decade working within the criminal justice system in Durham County and is the co-founder of a restorative justice project in Durham. Amy, welcome to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's wonderful to be here.
Also joining us from the studios of WRMA in Harrisonburg, Virginia, is Dr. Howard Zehr. He's a professor of restorative justice at Eastern Mennonite University and is sometimes called the grandfather of restorative justice. Howard Zehr, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
How would you define, Howard Zehr, this restorative justice? What is it?
Well, many people think of it as a dialogue between victims and offenders, as we've just heard, and that can be part of it. But it's really much more than that and doesn't necessarily involve a direct dialogue. Sometimes that can't happen or it's not appropriate for some reason. It's really, as you defined it at the beginning of the show, it's about addressing the harms and needs come out of that harm, addressing the obligations, particularly the offender's obligations, but any other obligations, and engaging as much as possible those who have a stake in this situation in the resolution of it. So it's really a framework for thinking about wrongdoing, whether we're talking about crime or we're talking about school disciplinary issues or even interpersonal relationships.
Why? What's the point of it?
Well, the point of it is that it's a very human kind of process. When our gut response is to punish people, the problem is that doesn't really help people learn to live together. It doesn't really work. If you look at the statistics on punishment, the research on punishment, it often works counter to what we think. What we're interested in is helping people to learn to build relationships, to live peacefully in a community. It's one of the reasons that the school movement that's really growing to use restorative discipline in schools is so important. Half of school is learning the curriculum. Half of it, as a researcher friend of mine says, is learning to live together. And when we can teach people how to manage their conflicts restoratively, we are actually helping to build more peaceful communities.
I heard that we've said that the community is one of the stakeholders in this. So we know there's a victim, a victim's family, the immediate people around the victim, friends and family. But what do we mean by the community, and how could they be involved in a restorative justice program? Can you map it out for me and give me a picture of how this might actually work on the ground?
Well, in most cases, probably the community is impacted. If my house is burglarized and I live in a community that's very safe, I've lived there 15 years, and I don't recall a single burglary in my neighborhood. If there were one, everybody would get uptight. Our trust would be destroyed. We'd start wondering whether one of the neighbor kids did it. We'd have all these kind of issues that would arise. So we would clearly be a stakeholder in it. Now, how do you include a community in that? Many times of restorative justice programs have allowed dialogues between victims and offenders when they want that to happen, and the community isn't present, although many of our programs encourage train facilitators from the community, so the community gets that kind of stake. There are kind of models, circle models and others, that do explicitly bring community members into that circle of dialogue. But at any rate, it means addressing those fears and those impacts. There's a new book out by a former judge named Ross London, and he argues that the fundamental harm of crime is the destruction of trust, and that we ought to be really focusing on how to rebuild trust. And that, of course, is the community as well as individual people.
Well, Amy Elliott, I should say right here now that I'm involved in a training in restorative justice that you and others are putting on here in Durham to talk about, you know, getting other people involved and understanding how this process works. So maybe you can give us an insight into the particular process that we're looking into, because I know it's the particular process that we're looking at is highly scripted and a formatted sort of a process.
Well, yes, it can be highly scripted, and as Howard Zayer said, it can also be a circle process, which can be more of a open discussion among the members who are there. But preparing community volunteers is so essential, just to give them the restorative justice framework, because it is so different than the traditional, whether you're looking at schools or the criminal justice system. It's a different philosophy.
You're working in schools and sometimes in juvenile detention centers. So right now what you're doing is working with young people. Give us an example of restorative justice process that you've been through, perhaps in a school.
Well, I can say, for example, in one charter school, there was a young boy who was very disruptive in class. He seemed to need attention constantly. And this went on, and we worked with him. But moreover, the students in the classroom worked together in the circle process. And slowly, he began to talk about himself and to take accountability for how disruptive he'd been. He apologized to the class, and he apologized to us as teachers. This didn't happen the first week. But as we used values and as we worked in the circle, he began to I think, feel like he could talk about his own awareness, became more aware. And it was very powerful when he apologized.
How does that work, Howard Zayer? I mean, I can hear people saying, okay, you get somebody who's committed a terrible crime, they've committed a murder, he's going to sit in a circle full of people, say, I'm sorry, and maybe hope that at some time will be taken off his sentence. It sounds like cheap grace. Why would this bring about healing, Howard Zayer?
Well, it may. Let me start by saying that restorative justice conferences, these encounters, aren't essentially about forgiving or about reconciliation. They are about meeting victims' needs and holding offenders accountable and engaging people, so that there are sometimes encounters where the victim just needs to tell this offender what they did to their life. And that's what they want to get out of it. And that's okay. There is preparation that has to go into it. And the story we had, you heard, there's a lot of preparation that goes into it, particularly as the crimes go up the scale towards severe violence. There's a lot of preparation that has to go into it. It has to be a safe space for everybody. Particularly the victim or survivor that's going has to make an informed choice. If this person is not going to take responsibility, they need to know that and make a choice about whether they participate.
Therese, go ahead. Finish,
go ahead.
Please.
No, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Therese, because I know you went into this not knowing anything about restorative justice, and you've learned things along the way. Tell us how that changed things for you and what you've learned in the process of making your film.
Well, let me clarify first that going into this process, I knew about restorative justice. I really became a student of Dr. Zayer's. So it's great to be on the phone with him. He was one of my heroes. I ended up getting a master's in criminal justice because I wanted to understand the system. I really was looking at the world, I think, through a restorative justice lens before I knew what restorative justice was. When I saw my brother's killer for the first time, and that shift in me said, wait a minute, he's just a person. He has a story just like you do and just like your brother did. And his family will lose someone just as I have lost someone, just in a different way. that was restorative justice. I didn't know what it was, but I found out several years later as I worked on a master's that, hey, there's this thing and it defines who I am. This is really cool. So when I went into the process, the victim-offender dialogue, I had total respect for what that process was going to be. And it certainly was victim-driven. I'm the one who started that, and that's the way it should be, because ultimately restorative justice is something that should be centered around what the victim's needs are, and certainly taking into account the offender, absolutely, and into account the effect on the community.
And you said something very interesting in the last segment when you said for the first time when you met Carl in prison, you finally felt in control of this process.
Yes, for the first time in a long, long time, I finally felt like I have a voice. And it wasn't for me, and it's different for every victim, so I never want to assume that I speak for all victims who go through this process. But for me, I didn't have a lot of questions about what he did. I really just wanted to sit across the table from him, see him as a human being, and let him see me as a human being, and let him see the impact, and just be able to say to him, I want you to know that you hurt me, not as a punishment for him, just as a human being. I wanted to say, you hurt me, the same way I'd say to one of my friends, you hurt me.
Well, Howard Zero, I've actually read an interesting essay on this, on restorative justice, that says, you know, in effect, what the state has done is taken our crime from us. They've appropriated the crime. It's in the name of the state, not in my name. I have no say in the process. I never get to confront the person who hurt me in my community, and in a way will never heal because they took my crime. Is that something that you agree with?
Absolutely. I mean, the crime is against the state. I was appointed by the judge in the Timothy McVeigh trial to help work with victims better. And, you know, the victims had to go to Congress to get the right to be in their own courtroom to hear their case. Because the crime was the federal government versus Timothy McVeigh. It's exactly what's happened. And we're not trying to argue that that's totally inappropriate, but we're arguing that there is this interpersonal, this human element that needs to be a central part of the focus.
Do we know anything about outcomes? We have a recidivism rate, I think it's upwards of 66%, something like that here in North Carolina. I don't know how much restorative justice is being practiced in the United States, but where it is, does it seem to have an impact on recidivism?
Well, there are programs all over the world. In fact, the rest of the world is sort of leading us at this point. There are more programs elsewhere than there are here. But there has been a fair amount of research, particularly on young people and recidivism, and it's pretty well across the board has shown a reduction in recidivism, 25% to a third, and usually if they do commit new crimes, they're not as serious a crime. So the evidence, we could use a lot more, but it's pretty promising.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that is?
Why does it have that effect?
Yeah, why would it have that effect?
We think that it's partly this empathy process, the fact if you have to, let me back up a little bit. The way an offender does what they do is by insulating themselves from the human consequences of their actions. They use all kinds of excuses and rationalizations. Psychologists sometimes call it neutralizing strategies to keep from understanding. I've had burglars say, I went in the house, I turned family pictures against the wall so I wouldn't think about that I was harming somebody. Then we put them in a legal system. As a judge friend of mine says, a central principle is put the state to the proof. Make the state prove it. So your attorney says, plead not guilty, make the state prove it. And then we put them in prison where there's no culture of taking responsibility, of thinking of the victim. I sometimes tell judges, it's like we created a system to reinforce the very mechanism that offenders used to get in trouble in the first place. So we believe that by humanizing this process, by allowing offenders to actually see the impact of what they've done, it can break through. It doesn't break through the first time all the time. I can think of a variety of cases where it took two or three meetings before they got it. Sometimes I worked on a serial rape case where it was one particular thing that the victim said that just really got to him, and he said it was the first time he'd ever understood what he did. But we think the empathy part of it, the encouragement to take responsibility, and the support. You know, it's interesting. I was at a conference, and there was a young man who had been a car thief, and he had stolen a bunch of cars from his particular car lot, and now he was friends with, he'd met them, and now he's friends with them. And so people in the audience were asking what made the difference, and he said it was respect. Everybody treated me with respect, and I didn't expect that. So that's an interesting element as well, I think.
Amy, you are, again, working in the juvenile justice area. Tell us about the reception you're getting and not so much the effectiveness, but the reception, and if there's any sort of reluctance going in, if the people who run the school or the detention center are skeptical at first about the process.
Well, no, I think there's people are looking for more effective ways. I think it's clear that there's a need, and so I feel there is an openness. The young people, it's very different for them. You know, they are used to punishment. They are not usually asked, you know, to listen to the victim and to take accountability. And so it's very new for them, and they ask a lot of questions. We showed them the documentary Burning Bridges, and, you know, they just couldn't believe that the community would come there and listen to these young people. And
this is a documentary that actually documents the entire process and shows some very angry people at the beginning who were very hurt by the destruction that was caused by the offenders, very angry and set in their ways. And in the process of talking to these people, became very sympathetic, and everybody in the end got what they wanted, it seemed to me, at least in that film that you're talking about.
I think so. You know, you saw the teachers of the young men come and speak about what fine young men they were. And you saw parents talking about how they were ashamed to go grocery shopping. They would go at 2 o'clock in the morning so they wouldn't have to face the people in their community. So I think for the young people, they saw how this healing process was really, you know, for the family, for the community, and that how their crimes really affected people. But it was very, they asked a lot of questions. And that what was so great in the detention center is being able to process the film with them and talk about it. And after we kept showing different documentaries and talking to them, eventually they all wanted to participate.
And what Howard said seems to me is very important. I want to ask how this works in the juvenile setting, because he said, we set up a system, an adversarial system that makes you insist on your innocence all the way through the process.
Right.
So why would you give up and say, I did it afterward? You know, it seems to me if you're working with young people, the idea, the very idea of getting them to take responsibility for what they did and say, I did this thing and it caused harm to these people, would be a pretty good thing very early in their lives.
Yeah, I think it can make a huge difference. You talk about recidivism, and I think just the fact that young people would have that experience within the juvenile justice system, which is the purpose of the juvenile justice system after all. You know, that's why their records are held secret. They're supposed to be, you know, going through a developmental time where they learn. And what a better way than restorative justice than to teach a young person that your crimes affect people, you know, and your family as well. And so I think they see that.
Well, Howard Zerr, there's always this talk about closure, particularly after a very serious crime, and people wanting closure. And I guess we've talked ourselves into the idea that punishment brings closure. I know there's a very big study out of England that talks about victim satisfaction in the restorative justice process. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Well, let me say something about the word closure first. I've talked to a lot of victims, and as one elderly grandmother, kindly grandmother, said to me, if you say closure, I'll give you a black eye. That word was actually, I heard a historian actually trace it, and that word came from the media and politicians trying to justify punishment, particularly the death penalty. It was a politically charged word from the start. You'll rarely hear survivors talk about that, use that word. They call it the C word. But that aside, the research is being pretty clear all across the board is that victims who choose to go through these process or offered the opportunity to go through these process are more likely to they have reduced trauma and stress. They have reduced fear. The study that you mentioned actually told the British government that we see enough signs of reduced post-traumatic stress that we believe if you adopted this nationwide, you would reduce the cost of health care because of reduced coronary disease and so forth that goes with post-traumatic stress. Satisfaction rates have been high, too, that virtually all the studies I've seen have found high satisfaction by both victims and offenders, actually, who go through these processes.
Therese, let me ask you where your case stands. Carl is set to get out of prison in a few months. Is that right?
He is.
And do you plan to meet him?
I don't. I feel like I have done what I needed to do, what I wanted to do. He has now, I just found this out the other day, actually, he has now been released into a pre-release type of program for the next couple of months, which will help him to, find employment, teach him life skills that he maybe has missed since he's been in. And I just want to go back really quickly and say something about the idea of closure. We were kind of all laughing when you mentioned the word closure, because a lot of victims, Dr. Zare said it perfectly, but a lot of victims just don't, it's not about closure, because you don't ever really get that. You know, at the end of the day, my brother is still gone. But what I do with that is what I have control over, and just making some sense of peace with what happened.
I want to thank you all for being on the program today. Great to talk with you. Therese Bartholomew is director and producer of the film Final Gift. It's about her brother's murder and her efforts to reconcile her killer with his killer. And you can see the trailer, thefinalgiftfilm.com. Howard Zare is a professor of restorative justice at Eastern Mennonite University in Virginia. He's also the banquet speaker at the Restorative Justice Conference in Raleigh. Amy Elliott is co-founder of the Restorative Justice Project in Durham. The National Conference on Restorative Justice runs tomorrow through Friday at the Sheraton Hotel in Raleigh, and you can get more information on that at restorativejusticenow.org. Just ahead on the state of things, we'll have a preview of the Found Footage Festival. Stay with us.